Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. All right. Welcome, everyone. Hello, and welcome to the November 2025 a Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. We hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday, and we are thankful for you and the work that you do every day. We're also very thankful for Limmer Education, who sponsors these journal clubs so we can bring to you the best of science in educational research. I'm Megan Corey. I'm here with Dr. Bill Toon and Michael Caduce, and we're going to bring you today this article in Pre-Hospital Emergency Care that you can access online. It is called Quality of Care and Opportunities for Improvement in Pre-Hospital Care of Critically Ill Pediatric Patients, an Observational Simulation-Based Study. Now, remember, if you miss any of our journal clubs, you can always catch us on our YouTube channel. You can subscribe to it also. It's www.youtube.com/@PCRF at UCLA. You can catch past episodes of both clinical and educational research journal clubs. If you hear something too that you like, you can quote, tag, share, hashtag EMS research or @PCRF at UCLA. And we'd appreciate that. And you can also tag our sponsor, Limmer Education. All right, thank you all for joining us today. We're going to begin. You can put comments in the chat. You can also type in questions in the Q&A, and we can bring those in to our discussion. So pediatric critical care encounters, I think, you know, you don't have to say it twice to EMS educators as to why you need more training and studying about pediatric critical care encounters and non-critical care for that matter. But in this case, we're talking about critical care encounters in the pre-hospital setting. We know they're infrequent in the pediatric population, and that makes it challenging for us to develop clinical expertise. And it's been about, that these authors cite, it's been about 20 years since these national organizations have advocated for the use of a pediatric emergency care coordinator, or a PECC, to help, you know, fill those gaps in education, improve the outcomes of pediatric patients. They also talk about simulation as in a really good opportunity to develop that expertise and to develop and study team-based learning as well, and team-based performance. They cite a study by Lammer et al., who showed that and developed validated scenarios in pediatric critical care. I'm going to see those three validated scenarios used in this research. We'll talk about those. And that with standardized checklists that go with them, and these were validated, which is kind of cool, because all I could think of, and I know we're going to talk about this with Bill and Mike, but we're going to talk about how you can probably replicate aspects of this study even internally for quality improvement. But this is a standard checklist that they use to examine pre-hospital skills. That's what Lammer had used. Now, what this group has proposed is using those standardized simulations in pediatric critical care encounters to identify key aspects of EMS team performance across three pre-hospital care simulations that you'll see. One is respiratory, another neurologic, another cardiopulmonary. So you'll see the specifics of that in a second. The primary outcome that they were looking at was team performance. So different than what had been studied before, which was kind of individual measures, we're looking at team dynamics and team performance as measured by these evaluations or interventions, either performed or not performed in simulation. So you have a scenario, you've got a standardized checklist. These are scenarios that were validated by Lammer and others. And they're going to use this now to evaluate team performance. And we're going to see that they've done this incredible effort across multiple states and in different types of agencies. The secondary outcome then would be to compare the quality of care, again, by these same indicators, for pediatric, for these PECC or versus non-PECC teams that are in different states, and to compare sort of agency performance and really states. They identify the states as states A, B, and C, so we don't know which states they are. They also talk about the demographics of the features or characteristics of these agencies, and you'll see that table in a second. So this is a prospective cohort study. It happens between 2021 and 2023. And these are agencies that are, again, three different states. They can be fire-based agencies. They could be a third service, or in one case, it's a private agency. And as part of, for the most part, it was would be as part of either continuing education or they were scheduled. All of these agencies performed within 2021 the asthma or respiratory with respiratory failure. This is a child asthma with respiratory failure. And respiratory arrest scenario in 2021. And then in 2022, these agencies performed, had their medics and EMTs, there's different mixes too of levels, had an infant cardiopulmonary arrest. And then in 2023, it was a neurologic, a sepsis seizure, again, an infant. So these were 11 agencies across three states. And I'll put up the description of these, but I would like to bring in Mike and Bill to talk a little bit about and to, bring in their discussion about this. The methodology in here is very worth pouring through if you're thinking about doing some type of improvement, if you're whether you're in initial education or continuing education, you run an ambulance service, or you're a training officer, very worth looking at this methodology. To kind of consider replicating something like this in your own agency, because we have three standardized simulations. Again, a child asthma, and you're going to see the checklist in a second. They're kind of busy, but with respiratory arrest, an infant cardiopulmonary arrest, and an infant sepsis seizure.
I think that's a great introduction, Megan, to something most of us probably struggle with, which is I worry when my providers have to take care of a sick kid because we don't do that very often in EMS. And so when I'm thinking about the, EMT or paramedic that's out on the street, I'm thinking through like they not only have to deal with the changes in anatomy and physiology that come, but also dealing with parents on scene and trying to provide a calming sense when even, this may be the first sick patient they've seen for the day or the first sick kid they've seen this year, and yet they have to remain calm themselves. So the setting up of this group of simulations and the study behind it, I think, is so ideal, where you've got a group of people that want to see how do we perform in pediatric simulation. And we'll talk all about all the good simulation tactics that they used in it, but I think they set it up really well. And I think this is a incredibly valuable question to be asking, which is, can we perform well in these low frequency, high stress, high criticality situations? So I just the authors did a really nice job in their introduction of sort of setting up why this is so important. And I put myself in our operational manager's shoes, and I think, like, yeah, these are the calls that scare me, right? And that not just does it scare me as the patient is sick, but I'm sending some folks that have 5 weeks of EMT education in to help, right? So I think the authors just do such a good job of setting the stage for why this is such an important study question. And again, it took them 3 years to do this. It's such a valuable question to start asking. So.
And the we were talking before this, there's basically two buckets to look at here when we talk about methodology. One is the simulation process itself. That we understand the importance of it. And actually, maybe some people need some emphasis on that out there. Because you do hear people say, well, this is simulation, reality is going to be different. Well, we know that. We all know that. But we don't think it's a good idea for people to go out there and say, well, I just have to go and run these critical calls in order to develop my expertise. We know that's not the case. To kind of look at the history of simulation and go to the airline industry, you don't see pilots or astronauts saying, well, it's not the real space shuttle. So, it's just a simulator. No, they simulate thousands of times and different ways in order to develop that. So they, when it does happen, they got something to work with.
Can you imagine astronauts being like, well, there's such a big difference between what we do in the classroom and what you do in the field. We just, really need to get you out there in order to do it. We're like, are you crazy? We don't send people into space and then just like, well, you'll figure it out when you get there. What a great analogy.
So the first thing I think is to cut through that piece is the belief in simulation. Bill, do you have something to add there?
Well, no, you both have hit it right on the head. And I've again, this brings me always when I hear you say something like this, or I hear this said, says, well, it's not like that in the field. I says, well, wait a minute. What we're doing here should be no different than what we're doing in the field. Other than we don't have the realism of per se, yeah, this is a real call, then this is a simulated call, but this is, I want you to make your mistakes here. I want you to miss your things here. I want to talk about it here. And I want to expose it to you here in the classroom. I remember one of the things I said to my paramedic students years ago when I had a program, I says, you're going to do everything in the classroom if twice, if not more, before you get to do it in the field. All the skills that were expected of them and stuff. And I says, I'm not going to wait. I'm not going to have you wait and learn it then, which is a very, why does this attitude exist that that's okay? It does. It's everywhere. He says, well, you'll get your chance in the field, or this will happen after you get a job. Then there's a fit. There's again a disconnect there. I don't want to say a failure. There's a disconnect. But I'm going to take a break and change the subject. Thank you, Anthony and Julie, for being here with us. You're the only two right here after Thanksgiving hanging out with us. So make sure you ask those
Hopefully having some
questions.
pie while you're a
Yeah, or a
little bit
cup of
of pie.
coffee or chilling out. So.
Thank you. To your point, I think I keep thinking, well, maybe part of it is that we don't really know always, and I'm not going to include everyone. We have lots of people out there who are have their certified health simulation educator who are working in really good high quality simulation, but I don't think that is the majority. So I think part of what may be happening out there, this that propagates this belief, is that there's too much focus on the let's make this simulation real, let's throw real this and real that, and not on the quality of the actual simulation as a teaching and learning tool. And so some of that I think is might drive that, well, this isn't real, that's not the, and so people tend to focus, oh, well, my students are saying that's not real, so let's make it real. We'll work on the moulage and we'll have people scream and we'll have people do this and that. And then forgetting that, what was the objective behind this? What is the, do we have standardized simulations? Do we have objectives that go with them? Do we, run them according to us and look at the, and evaluate according to a standard checklist of things that we would like to see performed or not performed in that simulation? Are they timed? Do we have a structured, guided debrief? The debriefing is not about me, it's about the student, right? It's about the learning, it's about the objectives. So that's another thing, is the debriefing, even just really good high quality evidence-based simulation practice. That may be why we see some of this. Who knows?
Well, you touch on something there. Again, you always touch on many things, but this whole concept of it also doesn't need to be complex to get learning. And I also think it would be a mistake to take someone in their first week of any EMS program and suddenly put them in one of these such a real, you're such a quote, real life thing. There's sirens and lights. You're setting them up for failure. That's a capstone type thing at the end. That's where you expect them to be able to do that because you built these skills over them over this time and you've integrated it in and you've made them familiar with them. I have no problem with simulation happening within that first week, but does it need to be the end all and be all? But you touched on something, the debrief, and I think I've heard this somewhere, but there's a, and I wish I could remember where it was. It was some podcast I listened to or something. Their debrief they use in the simulation is the same debrief the agency uses after complex calls in the field. So they're embedding it in one point, then putting it in, and it's to bring context to debriefing calls instead of calls just being shoot from your hip. Well, how did you think you do? And they actually have a system so the debriefs are in real life are structured just like the debriefs and simulation should be structured.
And there's lots of evidence behind debriefing of what works, what doesn't, advocacy inquiry types, and plus delta, and all these other different types of debriefing. There's a lot of good evidence behind it about what promotes learning retention, and change in practice, in clinical practice. In fact, we actually looked at a few of these in this journal club, and one of them was pediatric. We looked at one a study, and this actually reminded me. I kept thinking maybe some of these researchers were the same, but we looked at one that compared four different types of continuing education for in pediatrics. And if you remember, it was like the one that really stood out as the one that had the greatest retention and learning was like the low fidelity tabletop drill, with pediatric mannequins and direct feedback and structured debriefing and everything,
It
not
was
the big long
out of the
simulation with
box type thing, you know.
So I thought that was pretty cool, and that stuck in my head, and I think this is that's a really good practice. And now if we can take it to the next piece, which is research. So we have this article. Again, there were two buckets that I was thinking of. One is the high quality simulation they use. And I would recommend any educator out there to take a look at the methodology from two angles. One is from the simulation angle. Could I run this type of simulation? It might take you to some of the references in the back that are the evidence for how to do different types of simulation. And then the other is the research, the quality of the research here that used simulation. So I think we need more simulation-based research in EMS in general, in EMS education in general. But I thought the quality of the integrity of the research in this was really solid when it came to they videotaped these simulations, which, by the way, is very easy to do now. They have these, I mean, you can hardwire them, you can move them, you can whatever, you have to store them, you have to come up with a system, but once you do, it's actually pretty easy. And then they looked at these videotapes. They had a primary scorer, and they had these secondary this team of secondary scorers. And then they had this whole, I mean, the scorers went through training first. They had mock video, or they had videos ahead of time. So before they conducted the video reviews of all these simulations, they used a set of videos for training and for I love this term, calibration of the raters. So ensuring inter-rater reliability. That's a step that I think, again, this has to be well thought out, not just from the perspective, of the educator, but the educator researcher. So I just thought that was great.
I think you're spot on, Megan. I think the technology aspect here is many of us have cameras in our classrooms now anyway, so we can record things. It's not that hard to add this in. I thought a couple of the things that they did in the actual simulation were really, really helpful. And again, trying to portray that real world environment. So they partnered these folks up based on how they would be paired up. So maybe it's an EMT and an EMT, which was actually their smallest group of people, but then mostly it was paramedic and paramedic or paramedic and EMT. They used the state protocol or the agency protocols, again, just sort of trying to maintain the realism to what this is in the classroom. Because again, these folks are like experienced providers, they're out in the field. So giving them the exact same sort of environment, they made sure that they had a script written for the family member of the pediatric patient, which I think is really important when we have different people saying different things that can very much drive your treatment in different directions. So just trying to keep that standardization across these three different states where they had their different sites, to me, goes back to those really great simulation best practices. You have a parent who's giving you the feedback, who's giving you the information. It is the same across the board, just, as straightforward as possible, but again, as realistic as what you would see in the field. I thought it was really good. I was going to say those reviewers were all people with pediatric experience as well. So again, it wasn't, we didn't just take a ER physician and say, okay, here, you're in charge, rate these scenarios. It was emergency physicians for children or children, pediatric, like EMS educators, is what I'm trying to say. Folks that were very familiar with what to expect and what to not to expect. And again, they're measuring a ton of different things. You have to be familiar with, like, how does a BVM fit, right, on a child? What is a Braslow tape? So I think those things all just are the things you can do real time that they did that hit those simulation best practices that we, are so try to get as much into it as we can.
Yeah, that's great. And you'll see the standardized checklist that we're talking about in a second. This table one breaks down all the characteristics of the agencies. And one of the things, it's important that they describe so that we can see, like, this is a variety of different agencies in different states. You see states A, B, and C, whether they're mo the majority have of agencies used were fire-based, or that participated, I should say, were fire-based. A couple third service and a private provider. You can see the populations and call volumes. They're not going to have the power, and they say it right up front. We're not describing these so we can cross compare them. They did try to kind of look at trends in terms of the pediatric emergency care coordinator, yes or no, if they had if they had one or not. But they did say in their discussion of, you know, setting up the research that they didn't power for that, for looking at that. They were really looking at the team-based or the teamwork as described by how the percentage of these interventions that you'll see in a second that were performed or not performed, and then comparing those. They did do a state to state and whether or not they had a pediatric emergency care coordinator. But this just shows you, and this is the other thing, you mentioned this. Would you know, you hear the word pragmatic studies. And it kind of, I don't know if you have to meet a certain thing. I don't know enough about that kind of the research terminology there is if you have to meet a certain thing to be called a pragmatic study, but it reminds me of it because they're in their natural setting, right? You're not studying this, you're not trying to hold things in to a falsely, you know, oh, we only want people with EMTs or paramedics. We only want this. The one state has a designation of EMT cardiac. They didn't try to hold that steady. They didn't try to normalize that. They just said, do your regular training with your regular protocols and your regular, you know, people in your teams. We'll ask you about those, what the mix is, but we're not trying to change that. We just want you to do this, and then we'll measure the outcome. Run these simulations that will run them in this good, high quality way, and then we'll evaluate them. So I thought that was great because that is kind of gets to that we do want it in a realistic environment. That is a realistic environment.
Absolutely. And I think that's this type of research, and you see lots of pragmatic studies in EMS, maybe because they're a little bit easier, because you don't have such tight control over who's being enrolled, what treatment parameters are doing. But I think in healthcare in general, we don't see as many pragmatic trials because we do want to tightly control who receives a procedure. And in some cases, that's good, right? I don't want to compare a 6-year-old receiving one medication with a 6-year-old getting the medication, because we're going to have different outcomes there, or there's certainly a high probability that that will happen. So I think in EMS, it's so much easier to do a pragmatic trial because you are sort of following what's in the real world, where an exploratory trial would have some very strict controls on it. So yeah, you don't see as many in healthcare, but I think in EMS, you do see a lot more pragmatic trials, to your point that we're trying to replicate what would like whoever comes through the door is who you're going to get, and that's
That's
who we're going
right.
to study.
Yeah, and I really like that. I mean, I like that. I think sometimes it means you're introducing all kinds of different variables that may not show as strong a results as if you tightly controlled them, but you're going to have to get there anyway because eventually whatever you're studying is going to, the purpose of it is to get it out there in the field. So this one, in this way, they kind of work backwards. However, there's been a lot of previous research leading up to this point, so I think that's why they can jump to this. So we have this is the little diagram that shows you kind of they had 166 simulations that were actually conducted in those 3 years. And you can see the spread, 54 respiratory, 62 cardiac, 50 neurologic. And then they had to exclude, and if you can see the exclusions, they're all technological. Whoops, no audio. I mean, we all have this happen. Uh-oh, forgot to press record. You know, audio didn't work. Audio cable was off. No video in a few, you know, or the video was, you know, incomplete. So that's, they were all the technological reasons, which took it down to, you know, 50, 51, and 39 for the different groups of respiratory, cardiac, neurologic total simulations. And again, these were across these 11 providers, three states. And then you see the team composition in terms of by state and by private third service or fire-based. Bill, do you have something to add to this before we jump in? Okay. So I put these in. They're long. There's basically this big table of table two that has the median number. This is the actual raw results of their review of these videos. And what you see are median numbers of simulation skills rated by simulation type and the frequency of the skill performance. So if you can imagine, the reviewers are watching these videos. They have these standard items. This has been developed and validated ahead of time. They're using that Lammer research and marking off whether or not they have performed these things. And now we're looking at the overall of performance of these skills. So this is all across all the simulations. And you can see that they do have a supplemental material that shows the ones that they were unable to determine. So if you're watching a video of a simulation, you see that they've applied a pulse oximeter, you can mark that out as yes, they did that. If you don't see it, haven't, you don't see that it's done, it's a no. But if somehow you didn't, weren't able to see something for whatever reason, that was unable to determine. And that was, again, agreement across these reviewers. So they looked at, agreement across these reviewers.
I
Michael,
think
do you have some?
one thing that came to my mind was like, I think in previous years, and maybe it's still out there today, but skill sheets sort of get, it's like a bad word sometimes in simulation to say we have a skill sheet. And I think that I'm not a believer in that. A 150 point checklist to put an oxygen tank together or to start an IV is probably a bit extreme, but I think there's still a value in having the ability to confirm someone did what you did, right? Did the learning objectives get met in this simulation? And I think having a check sheet like this, where you can sort of validate those parameters that you want to see. This is maybe a little bit different use of a skill sheet in that we're more tracking what all got done rather than these are the expected actions. But I can appreciate that they used a tool which they have, I would say, is probably reasonably validated between this study and some previous literature, because it says they adapted this skill sheet from what was previously used. So I think you could reasonably say that they used a validated skill sheet in doing this. So I appreciate that they had a skill sheet and they had a way to evaluate it. I'm going to share my comments about some of the results findings until I let Bill talk.
I think that's also the difference, I think, between what I call a task analysis when you're first teaching the skill versus what has ended up used as some kind of evaluation tool. And that's often confused. And there may be people that go, task analysis? What are you talking about? And I think there's a role for that detailed task analysis so the person can learn it. But it's not the way you later on evaluate their performance. And so they're different kinds of things. And I'm excited to go over some of the things they didn't do here in a minute.
Ginger Locke and Medic Mindset has a microsode. It's several years old, but it's a micro episode, like 10 or 15 minutes long. And it's on overlearning. Look it up, Medic Mindset Overlearning. And she goes through a lot about, the idea of the task analysis when you're first learning a skill versus later when you're doing an evaluation of that skill. And that we've looked at this quite a bit because I know in anesthesia especially, we've had a couple of studies we looked at with intubation and use of simulation, and we had that hybrid simulation study we looked at that I love following those researchers. And the skill, the sheet that they used, we also looked at it in pleural decompression, I believe. They asked the experts, like, what are the most important things that are evidence-based according, that will improve outcome? And that's the other thing. So there's two things. One is it at least experts are telling you this, they need to do this because it'll improve outcomes. Or, do we have that actual research that says if they don't do this, this could really hurt people? So that's when I look at this checklist, it's really long and has a lot of little individual things. And my first thought is how many of these are evidence-based or are, maybe just experts in pediatrics that have said, you got to do this. Are some of these like more important than others that stand out?
I remember that pleural study we talked about because one of the sites, it just drives me crazy. It's like cleanses the site before insertion. You're like, there's no evidence you're going to get an infection from a needle decompression, but it's in every textbook, it's on every skill sheet, and you're like, you don't need to wipe down with alcohol first, but like proper placement is really, really, really important to the success of the skill. So those would be a great example of the stuff that matters versus the stuff that doesn't make a big difference.
And considering the majority of the time the needle doesn't enter the pleural space, that's
Yeah.
another topic all in itself.
Really important things have to happen versus those things you're like, great. I'm like, thanks for wasting some time before you save the patient's life. So,
Well, the
I
one
go ahead.
just on the pleural decompression, the one I always question, and I've never been able to find a good answer, is there a need for a flutter valve?
Oh, yeah.
That's exact. I mean, where does that come from? You know, and it's finding
Movies.
some things that are, huh? Yeah, well, or
Movies.
just old habits. You know, with
Yeah.
my history thing I've been doing, it's amazing things that I've seen that were done 100+ years ago that we're still doing now
Yeah.
that don't necessarily make any sense.
The
Yeah.
trauma compendium that NAMSP put out that we did last week on the
Yeah.
clinical podcast, the one on spinal motion restriction says we literally went back a century looking at evidence on this. And it befuzzles me that like we've been doing this 100 years and we still can't figure it out. But let's not, we affected us, Megan. There's some really good results here.
So what we're seeing is that in the bold, these are, again, if you've performed it greater than 70% of the time, we've seen these performed, and not bolded, or you can see that these are numbers that are below 70%. So inserting an OPA, correctly sizing an OPA, 32%, 36% of the providers actually did this. And again, this is yes, no, or unable to determine. If it was unable to be determined, if more than half of them were unable to be determined, they removed it entirely. So you don't even see those in here. These are the ones where they could determine it. I do like the quality indicators that have time elements to them. I don't know, again, how much evidence, but I do like the idea that they're quality indicators that have time associated with them, BVM within a certain period of time. Or I thought two-person BVM was really interesting because we emphasize that so much in adults. Maybe that's a training thing. Maybe in initial training, we just don't emphasize that in children as much. So you see that as a lower percentage.
And they note that in their discussion, which I thought was really interesting. Of all the things that they picked, those were the interesting ones. There were a couple of them that I thought were really good. The auscultating lung sounds came up 96% of the time. I was like, yes, that's
Yeah.
a. There were two of them that I thought that were both national EMS quality metrics that we track and sort
Oh,
of look.
I'm glad you brought
So,
that up. So these are the.
auscultating lung sounds and counting a respiratory rate, right? Or did you complete a respiratory assessment? I think it's technically just pulse ox and respiratory rate are the two things for the NIMSQA standard. But they, ironically, 96% of people listen to lung sounds, but only 62% of them counted a respiratory rate. And I was like, I wish I could say I'm shocked that they're not counting respiratory rates
Yeah.
in anybody. But that one came up. And then that using a Braslow tape, for this study, it was specific to weight for intubation, but just collecting a weight on a pediatric patient is another NIMSQA measure. So I was appreciative that both of those were actually bolded and that they actually like people were doing them, which is good. It's also those NIMSQA measures are all evidence-based practices, so there's evidence that says this is a really important thing to be doing. So I thought those two
That's what
things.
I thought. Can we marry NEMSQA measures? I was going to ask this too. Those kind of the known quality indicators that have evidence behind them with some of this research and our checklists. And even in initial education, this is the evidence that of quality, and let's put this into our initial education and continuing education.
I thought so, and we were going through a whole thing with pulse oxes and respiratory rates and stuff. So I thought that's where that one came up. But I was happy to see that same thing. Like they put a pulse ox on, they put the cardiac leads on. I think those things all in my book were like good. We're sort of meeting the baseline of what I would expect when you walk into a respiratory patient.
And then the cardiopulmonary arrest. So I'm showing each one, and I'm sorry, they were tiny and overlapping tables, so I kind of put them together. But so they did the same for each one. So now you have 58 possible measures here, and what 43 were able to be measured. The others were unable to, and those again are in the separate table. But giving bag valve mass ventilation within 60 seconds is only 33%, but performing it is 94%, right? So again, those I thought something like that, the timeline, it made me say, is that a NEMSQA measure?
I thought it was interesting because I know we have this literature that says we're really bad at ventilating patients at the right rate, right? We always hyperventilate them. And in both the respiratory and the cardiac arrest, I think for respiratory, delivering the 12 to 20 ventilations per minute was 64% of the time. So we're hyperventilating, reasonably half the patients too fast, and then gave BAG/VAV mass ventilations within 60 seconds, only happened about a third of the time for our CPR patient too. So I was like, oh, I think we're still trying to fight that hyperventilation thing.
Well, I just want to chime in. I always had a pet peeve about BBM measurement, particularly in evaluations, is the, and this may have been a leftover from the days of state checklist for final evaluations or registry checklist. It always talks about the need to, well, you got to place an oral airway and you got to have oxygen hooked up to your BBM. And people often will do all of that first and then begin ventilations. And that doesn't make any sense to me. These are self-refilling bags. You grab the mask, you put it on, you begin to ventilate. Then you can add an oral airway. Then you can hook up oxygen. We would get ventilation started sooner if we took and said, yes, these all need to be components of this, but you don't need to have an oral airway in before you can begin to ventilate. And I spent 10 years working in an operating room teaching paramedics. Anesthesia doesn't rarely puts an oral airway in. Because you, if you get good head positioning and mask seal, you don't need an oral airway. They would only put it in if they couldn't ventilate. And so we have some things that I think we've taught people that intentionally delay getting a critical skill established. And so we need to look at that. We have, I think, owned some responsibilities when performance is poor.
The inserts oral pharyngeal airway correctly was bolded in both of them, but I thought it was ironic for the respiratory case. It only happened 36% of the time, and then it was almost the exact same for the cardiopulmonary. And I'm trying to check where I saw that, but yeah, it was only 30% of the time. So I was like, gosh, I feel like that's something we harp on and harp on and harp on. And then I thought to myself, again, they only had like one or two teams of EMTs. And I was like, I wonder if it's because in paramedics we harp on these advanced airway procedures versus the basic airway procedures, where if there were just two EMTs in the room, I bet we'd have a higher percentage of those doing OPAs. That made me chuckle. I was like, oh, some of the basic things are not getting covered, but like the correct placement of the IO, like we nailed. So.
Well, one of the things that I've been searching for it, but I didn't look at the unable to determine was they're talking about auscultating lung sounds after intubation, but not waveform capnography,
I saw that too.
which I would think would be. And so and then I thought, well, maybe that's in the supplement. I'd have to, in fairness to the authors, I didn't read that carefully, but most people would say that is, and it's evidence-based,
It's
the way
Bluetooth
to
gold standard,
confirm.
yeah.
So so and this is the cardiopulmonary arrest, and then we have the neurologic sepsis seizure. So and again, a lot of checks. Pulse rate, spontaneous respirations. I mean, that's probably rate. Reassures the caregiver that the seizure will stop or be treated. I thought was interesting. That was about 41%.
And again, the Braslow tape comes back for weight-based dosage. So that came back in both the cardiopulmonary resuscitation
Both.
and the neurologic one. So I'd just like to see it across the board. I'm like, good. I saw in the methods they said like use any tool you would reasonably have available to you. So I'm like, good. Get on your phone and Google it, right? But I appreciate when people are recognizing what tools they have at their disposal and they're willing to use it. So that
And
made me.
yet, give the correct dose was
Yes.
below. So you're using the tape, but we're not given the correct dose. So, yeah, and that has been a very, a consistent problem, right,
I'm
for
still
seizure
looking
patients.
forward to the day we have the engineering solution to the wait for pediatric
Totally.
patients,
The
where,
AI solution.
well, or, and as simple as this, there's this pad you throw down. You place the child on it to do all your resuscitation, and that pad weighs them,
Oh, I
and
think
then
where it's
can
going to
calc
be
then
even
can then
easier.
can then can calculate the dose for you. You know, I mean,
Yeah.
yeah, there is, but I think there's an engineering solution that hasn't been found or implemented yet.
Yeah. I still say it's going to be AI. They're going to do all this, ability to just
Hanging
kind
from
of
the ceiling.
scan and say, give this much, and not even have to. Same with GCS. If you talk out loud, I think they'll be able to say your GCS is. It's like, thank you for calculating that for me. All I had to do was talk out loud as I assess the patient.
And one day we need to really see what the value of GCS is, but that's the totally other story.
Yeah, and actually, do we have that in this checklist for the neurologic? We have nuchal rigidity, which I think is interesting. But if you have a patient who can't really respond to you, I would imagine a septic shock seizing patient's not going to be able to. I'm not surprised that zero of them tested for nuchal rigidity in somebody like that. So.
Well, not only that, again, how well are things like that covered? You may be using a term that people are totally unfamiliar, you know.
So this is interesting. You were just saying when we were talking about drug dosages. Yeah, there's a study that's ongoing right now called PD Dose that is about are you involved in that, Michael, or are you guys a
In
site?
LA. Yeah, I don't know the word site, but it's in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's all over the country, and it's about standardized dosing by I think it's age group. By age group rather than just, I mean, that's the other thing is people don't realize that Breslow is not, it's a length-based tape, but the length is just telling you what the 50th percentile of their weight is if they're this tall. It's still going by weight. You're just using the length. And of course, kids come curled up and doubled over, and we don't stretch them out to measure them if they're doubled over in abdominal pain, right? So that weight is helpful.
Exactly. And a couple other things that I thought were interesting with the neuro one is we had a couple we only had, we had less than 40% ask about medications and 41% ask about allergies, yet it looks like the majority of them gave a
Gave
benzodiazepine.
them a, yeah,
And there is a
yeah.
NIMSQA standard. I'm almost positive there's a medication check for this, but I thought the other thing too was the majority of them started an IV or an attempted an IV. And I kept thinking back to like, wouldn't you just, why not just give it intranasally? So I think that's sort of like, I also one of the methods things too said like these patients were very straightforward. Like you did, your patient was going to go into cardiopulmonary arrest no matter what. Like even if you did everything right, and so I wondered if some of these things were like you see that those that gave a second dose gave the correct second dose. I guess if you're giving a second dose, you're probably more confident in your numbers of what you're giving the patient. So it sort of makes sense that the more drugs you're giving, probably the more competent you are in giving those drugs. Didn't know, much about your benzodiazepines, you probably wouldn't know that you should, you could give it again if it didn't work for the seizure.
Well, the
So I thought.
Rampart, I always go back to the Rampart study, and then even organizations that are using the IM route are giving a sub dose from the Rampart study. They're only giving five when
Yes.
it recommended 10.
Ten.
And I'm going, hello, how you shouldn't be surprised it's not working. This not what the study said to do.
Yeah, you can't scream. We need to do evidence-based medicine and then say, oh, I know the evidence said that, but we're going to do half because we're concerned about side effects. It's like, but the evidence said it was okay. There weren't any side effects.
Yeah, I hear about that one all the time,
All the
and that
time.
always surprises me.
This, I think this one, the neurologic sepsis seizure one, had by far the most variability inside of the items, where and a little bit confusing. Give a benzodiazepine 12%, give correct dose of midazolam 66%. So I'm like, okay.
The very few people who gave it, I guess, again, I
I
go
guess
back,
so. Yeah, I guess
you were
it's of
giving
the
it.
people who
Yeah,
gave
and I
it.
guess I'd go back to like, I guess if you were giving it, you felt confident in what you were doing, right? The people that were less confident with pediatric medication administration just didn't give it, which I guess if you don't know what you're doing, I'd rather you not just guess. But to me, I literally asterisked that one. Like, gosh, you have a seizing kid in front of you, and only 12% of people treated it. Like, we can do better than that.
For sure. And then the meds and allergies, I think that really stood out for me too. Even examining, checking the pupils, I mean that stood out. This is a neurologic patient. And this is obviously a shock patient because they're septic as well, and we don't have a whole lot of shock treatment here either.
No, they measured who gave pressors, and that was zero. They did have about half of them give a fluid bolus.
Do you know
It's
what this
interesting.
makes?
Oh, go ahead.
This makes me still think about It will be interesting to see what the impact of body cameras have in the sense of us really finding out this is in simulation, they're not doing this. What really happens in the field in the same kind of situation? And we find out that it could possibly be worse, that they're really, oh, they're seizing. They don't do any assessment and they just go right to a drug. And I don't know if that's right or wrong. You know, I'm not
Well,
saying
you do
that.
have to
I'm
check a
just.
pulse, and the check a pulse here is only 51%, and
Yeah.
people do go into cardiac arrest and have twitching
Yes.
and their
Yeah,
eyes roll up, and
but I'm
so
interested to know what really happens in real life. It's going to be, it, body cams have the chance to really change our future and even how we educate and work on people, not work on people, help people get better to take care of patients.
totally agree. So then let's look at the summary stuff, unless you have anything more about the specifics. But the now that was the and there's so much to that those specifics. They're really worth taking a dive into and looking at. And then so now they're summarizing what's the mean percent of skills overall by simulation type, and then by state identified as A, B, and C, and by the pediatric emergency care coordinator status, which they admit is not the study's not powered to actually look at. So the one of the things that stood out so is that respiratory, and you'll see this in a future in the next slide, that the respiratory simulation performance was higher than the others, the cardiac and neurologic in terms of the mean percent of skills performed for all states together. And they broke it down by agency, by again the PECC agency versus non. And you see some differences, but there weren't any not statistically significant. Look at the big standard deviation in some of them. So the neurologic and the cardiac in particular.
And that was
So
one of my is you have the standard deviation of almost 10%. So you have wide variability. Sorry, Bill, I cut you off.
No, that's okay. What I was, Megan, you talked about the pediatric emergency care coordinator, and a lot of people don't even know what that is because it's still not widespread. I put a link in there to the pre-hospital pediatric readiness program
Thank you.
because they have this already in the ED. There's an emergency department pediatric readiness. We're growing the pre-hospital pediatric readiness. And that's where this idea of there's a champion within an ambulance service who's there to try to make the care of pediatric patients better.
There
And
are so
it's,
many now too. Many
yep.
emergency physicians, pediatric specialists, pediatric nurses, and even now pediatric clinic pre-hospital provider,
But there's it's
designated.
growing. It is growing, and that it's necessary. But wait, we're going to have the same thing for geriatrics one day if I have anything to say about
Seem to
it. But
start
you and
that
I,
way.
Dorset, are pushing on that, which is great. It's a good thing
That
to go.
is great.
And
Yeah,
that
we
because.
do. There's a group at both NEMSP and SAEM working on the geriatric readiness program.
Yeah, and I don't know where there's a conversation for another time, but there was a ACEP had a designated geriatric emergency, and I don't know where that's
There's an
headed, or
accredited
whether they've got,
accreditation process for your emergency room, different levels, yes. There, but it hasn't made anything to the pre-hospital field. You know, I give NEMT great credit for their program that they
Jones,
have, but it's not well utilized, I think, and there may be opportunities there to promote that more and expand that more. So I think you're going to see more at the geriatric level as we've seen at the pediatric.
Sort of makes sense. The majority of our patients are that way. Megan, I was going to say one thing on the last table, and that is the authors note that the respiratory, and you said this too, the respiratory case study did the best, but it's not by much. If you look at this, it's maybe a couple percentage points. I thought it was interesting because the authors noted in their discussion too that the respiratory simulation was run first. And granted, these things weren't run like back to back. They were one year, the next year. So there was some space in between. But thinking that, well, maybe the practitioners got better over time because they remembered this simulation they ran the first time. It certainly doesn't look like that's the case.
No, not at
It
all.
looks they actually sort of got worse. So, but again, I would say worse is a relative term because it's it's like 1 or 2 percentage points. So it's really not going to be. I don't know that they actually tested for significance, but their performance over, I would say, it was actually fairly congruent.
Yeah, neurologic is more, it's more complex, although I thought it was interesting that we were calling this less common. I would have thought seizures in babies would have been much more common. Maybe seizures and sepsis together would have been, but seizures in pediatric patients, I wouldn't think is of these others. Respiratory, you'd think, okay, asthma, child asthma maybe. But I would put the seizures next before cardiopulmonary arrest. But
I would too. I wonder if maybe they're thinking that this patient was having a more generalized seizure rather than like the afebrile type seizure or something like that. But yeah, I would agree with you. I would put cardiac arrest at the bottom, and I think the analysis of across the country on what EMTs and paramedics actually do would probably verify that they treat a lot more respiratory and neurologic conditions than cardiac arrest.
You make a good point about the just highlighting that each year these were done. So basically, that suggests to me that you saw that table that most of the agencies had at least annual training. Most of them had once a year on pediatrics. So that makes sense that they would say, okay, if you want to participate in the study, can you do this simulation with these parameters and we'll train you and whatever. So they're participating in a study, but it's part of their regular training. So it's, the providers aren't going to remember, oh yeah, that's this study that we're doing next year. It's just their regular pediatric training that they're going to.
I
So
thought about.
that's,
Yep, sorry, Megan.
no, go ahead. That's what I was just, it's not like they could influence it. I don't think there's a whole lot of individual, EMS influence on this.
I agree with you on that one. That table also showed that there's two agencies that do not require any pediatric certification. And not that I think taking a PALS class every 2 years substantially prepares you any better than not, but at least it's something. And I was just surprised. I would have a hard time working with an ALS agency that was like, we require zero pediatric certifications. Like, ooh, I mean,
And that's not continuing. That's at
just
all.
in the door, right?
Yeah, in the door. So, because they did ask about continuing.
They asked about, and that, I think doing continuing education versus the certification. I'm not a card guy, but I am a content person, and I think that that's more important. If they're not doing anything for initial or continuing pediatric education, I have a big concern there. And we used to measure that more. That was a bigger thing that when I was working in Kansas, we made sure we had every year there was X amount of pediatrics built into our continuing education program. So we knew annually, forget the ABC courses, we knew annually we were covering pediatric topics, of course, that were based upon our quality assurance program. So we knew where our areas of weakness were.
And there's so much opportunity, right? You think of like drowning happens more often in kids than not. So like when you're doing your drowning training, you probably should focus it on children. I think the same thing in the fall, especially in places that have higher allergen and pollen counts, like you're going to exacerbate your asthma patients. That seems like a prudent time to be doing. I mean, we do the same thing. We do our frostbite and our hypothermia training before the winter comes, right? Like it seems like there would be some opportunity to very easily insert some training like this and like, hey, it's asthma season. It's coming up. Like, I know you can get it from anything, but there are times when we see it fluctuate. So there just seems like some opportunities there, but that just kind of surprised me. I was like, your bare minimum is we do an annual training and we don't require any certifications. Ooh, we can, there's an opportunity there.
So this is their effects of the scenario and the status, the PECC status and state on team simulation performance. The more you break these things down, the less likely you are to see because of the numbers and everything else. But they wanted to, they did say at the beginning they wanted to compare the secondary outcomes. The simulation types, we talked about that respiratory came across barely, but came across as the one that was had the most of their critical criteria hit. And then they looked at states, which I thought was interesting. And then they broke it down by state and simulation type. And that's when you get the small numbers. But respiratory seems to kind of come up and state B over the others, over A and C in respiratory, or actually over A in respiratory, and then state B over C, which was over A. in the neuro treatment. So don't know how much you can say about that, but it was they just kind of wanted to take a look at that, and it doesn't really, to me, I can't really make any, you can't make any conclusions just because there's only a couple of agencies within states. We don't know whether state
Agree.
protocols have anything to do with it or anything like that.
I would agree, and I would be interested. Like they don't tell you what the states are, and that's good research practice. But you could, especially when you're comparing them, it would be an opportunity if you were one of the states that had lower performing one of these areas. If you do have state requirements for renewal and things, to be like, okay, we performed the least on the respiratory scenario. Let's make sure in the renewal requirements we require an hour on pediatric. Respiratory distress or arrest. So there could be, I could see some opportunities from there. Yeah, I wouldn't draw too many conclusions from it, but I also wondered too what state protocols they were using, right? Some states are much more of, I don't know, I was going to say progressive, but maybe just are more willing to let you intubate versus not intubate or try in some of the less advanced procedures. Some places are still using King tubes. Some places have IGELs where we're a little bit more comfortable with pediatrics, right? So I wondered too if state protocols played a little bit of a role in some of these.
Yeah, and I think that's why they brought it up, because two of them, they used state protocols, had statewide protocols, and one had, more regional or local. Maybe it was a delegated state or a state that, had delegated that to local protocols or local medical directors. So, which I think is, again, worthwhile putting in there, because now it kind of, there's the seeds of a question there to expand upon. Bill?
Well, hopefully that's what all research does, is it leads to more questions and more researches. So I'm going to act as the wrap-up person here for myself, and I just want to say I want to thank these authors for publishing this and sharing this. It's really good. And to our attendees, thank you for being here, and I hope you're in an agency that embraces this or interested in this. Remember, there's a lot of detail here that you could take and do at your agency, at least to find out how well you're doing in your organization against a larger database of information. And I do look forward to one day when we really can do research on the vast majority of all the patients we take care of, so because it would be nice to have real stuff that's there. But these authors did a great job, and there's a lot to be learned. So please read this if you haven't.
I agree. I was telling Megan before we started that Dr. Mark Cicero is somebody who I cited in my one of my last master's like thesis at the end on pediatric triage. So if you want to read more on any one of these pediatric simulation topics, these authors have published other stuff that is really interesting and worth sharing, and that we still see probably being true this to today. So yeah, hats off to the authors for a really well organized and coordinated study. This one took work.
Yes, and thank you for all of your research that you've been producing on pediatric pre-hospital care. And I just love that they said the gaps here can inform our educational and our quality improvement objectives. That I think is so true. And thank you everybody for joining us today. We do have another one coming up. Guess what? It's that time of year. December 19th is going to be our Best of Education Research in 2025. And before then, I believe December 8th, the Clinical Journal Club will be doing their Best of Clinical Research in 2025. Because you can have a really full, December with all of this best of, and you could pick up a lot of great research during that time. We're going to be ready combing the literature and pulling our favorites together for you. So please join us live each month. You can register at prehospitalcare.org, and don't forget our YouTube channel. You can go there and subscribe if you have to leave or you can't attend. Any final thoughts, you guys?
Happy
Thank you,
holidays.
everyone. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.